Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
So with me in studio today, I have Mick Clifford, Special Correspondent for the Irish Examiner, Ciara Murphy, Senior Policy Officer at the ASRI, Graeme Finlay, Assistant Professor of Politics and International Relations at UCD, and Brenda Parr, columnist at the Irish Daily Mail and Sunday Times. You're all very, very welcome. Mick, I might just start with you. You know, when we came on air last Sunday morning, the fresh presidential news was that businessman Gareth Sheridan was coming forward as a presidential hopeful. We probably didn't anticipate the main news story this week being the possible re-emergence of Heather Humphreys as a candidate.
Well, nobody could have anticipated it, Derval. You know, obviously with the exit of Mairead McGuinness, and I think everybody wishes her well in her health issues there, but I think it's absolutely changed everything with the presidential race. This kind of started, I think that was Thursday, she announced it by Friday. This got going, it's taken on a lot of momentum now, and that is that the most likely candidate from Fine Gael is now going to be Heather Humphreys. Now, the Sunday Independent have quoted her as saying that she's seriously considering it. So unless something arises for her personally or something between now and whenever she makes her decision, I'd say it's nearly nailed down at this stage.
Yeah, there was some report saying that Mairead McGuinness's backroom team have stepped up or are willing to step already up to back her already.
Yeah, and the only other person who's indicated that they might be interested is Sean Kelly, who is a very proven vote getter in the Ireland South constituency, and he's a very solid GA base. But the thing about Heather Humphreys, to my mind, is that she, her reach would be beyond the Fine Gael base. She comes from a community background. Also, she's a border county. She's from the Protestant tradition at a time when we're moving towards change, perhaps on the island and what have you. And her personality, all of that.
And also strong rural support.
Exactly.
A lot of the
all of that would go in her favour. That's the main thing. The interesting thing, and Brenda here is one of those three columnists, from what I can see, are suggesting that Bertie Ahern's position, should he wish to run, has improved as a result of events this week. Now, I'm yet to be convinced of that, I have to say myself, but as I say, that's out there most definitely. And it's really now down to what Fianna Fáil and Sinn Féin are going to do.
Could Fianna Fáil, do you think, passively support Heather Humphreys if they decided not to run a candidate?
They could. Now, you know, how exactly that would be regarded among the grassroots, whether that's a diminution of their status or whatever, and they haven't run one for the last two elections, that's quite possible. The other thing is with Sinn Féin, to my mind, they're absolutely not going to run a token candidate. They're going to run somebody with a view to winning. And if they were to do that, I think the only people possible are Mary Lou MacDonald, who would have an extremely good chance, or possibly Michelle O'Neill. Beyond that, I can't see them going anywhere else. But if those two parties run people, I think the chances of independent candidates getting a nomination through the council are massively reduced at all, and you could be down to just the main parties having people, bar of course Catherine Connolly, who's the one confirmed person in
The only confirmed candidate. And there's Ciara, do you think that Heather Humphreys would be hard to beat given that broad support that she has, even with maybe all of the hang-ups about, you know, housing and, you know, referenda etc. last year? Do you think she would be a strong candidate?
I'm not sure. I think I'm not very good at following politics. I always say that I'm way more interested in policy than politics. I do think that as a young person who grew up in the recession, I, and many young people that I know have echoed this, feel like I could not live in a country if Bertie Ahern was elected president. I would be like, oh my God, did we learn nothing? Do we remember nothing from what happened during that period? And, you know, the economic choices that were made. I mean, he's very much reframing his candidacy in terms of the Good Friday Agreement, but
he hasn't reframed anything at all. He hasn't come forward
candidate. Sorry, but there's been like a very strong campaign on his part to reframe his legacy
I wonder, Good Friday Agreement. Brenda Parr and Ciara says, you know, have we learned nothing? We learned a lot about Bertie Ahern through the tribunals in all of those years. I think what you were saying in your own piece this morning is that Ahern's advantage over rivals, if he's serious about running, is that he knows what the tricky questions will be. He knows exactly how dirty his rivals will fight. He's had plenty of awkward interviews.
You see, this is it, Derval. I mean, the point is that what we have seen from the last couple of election campaigns is that the person who withstands the bloodbath that this is going to become. And you can see already from what has come out about the putative candidate so far, is the one who is going to win the presidency. And it, above all of them is the point I'm making. Bertie is the one who has been put through the ringer and who has been able to answer questions, satisfactorily or not, whether or not you're happy with his answers. But the point is he was before the tribunal for, I think, 13 days on 11 separate occasions. And he now frames the tribunal's findings as kind of, well, they gave their views and I gave mine. And that is going to be his response. And I think, you know, If this is how we are going to run presidential elections, then I can see him. I could see him winning. And I mean, there's a piece in the Mail today saying that he has serious support within Fianna Fáil. There's a quote saying, "Micheál won't enter because of the same fears that Mary Lou has. The concern is that if he doesn't win, he loses the presidency and the party leadership." And one Fianna Fáil minister commented, "If there was a vote in the parliamentary party as to who to pick, the Bert would win. He would win a popular vote, defeat any combination of O'Keefe, Hannafin or Amurku. People are fed up with being taken for fools. Bertie would being chosen would be a rap across the knuckles for our betters."
And Sheena Ross also, I think, had a piece kind of suggesting that there might be widespread support in the party, even if the leadership had some questions.
Graham, he also does well in all the polls.
Yeah. Graham, what do you think as an outsider looking in? Because obviously, I suppose the Trump card is the peace process. Is sure. it enough?
The first thing is I'm available. I'm a Protestant who can relate to the Irish diaspora abroad. You know, I have at least the public profile of Gareth Sheridan. I just want to point that out. Yes. But no, seriously, I mean, the Ireland I moved to in 1999 was Bertie Ahern's Ireland. And so I have a different form of scarring than Keir has, you know. And I just think if you're relying on the amnesia of people younger than Keira, right? And, you know, that's not a great sort of selling card. I think we're looking for someone like Michael Dee, regardless of their political affiliation, who doesn't have a very strong track record to be used against them. And Heather Humphreys suffers from that. Whereas Michael Dee was running on being the Minister for the Arts like 20 years before. So I think they're looking for someone with that kind of charisma. I don't think it's Catherine Connolly because she doesn't have the aura that Michael Dee had. I remember watching him walk past the Shelburne long before he ran for president. And people were just touching him and people really just wanted to be next to Michael Dee because he didn't have any negative baggage, right?
Yeah, I remember Fianna Fáil Ardeshena where people were also like that with Bertie Ahern. Mick Clifford.
Brenda's point there about the last person standing is absolutely well made. What I would say, however, though, is my recollection of Michael Dee being the last man standing in 2011 was that he was one of the few that didn't have a history that was dragged out. A lot of it unfairly with some of the candidates, yet it stuck. But Michael Dee was able to stand to the side and all this brickbat stuff went on and he eventually emerged. The thing with Bertie is this. In the 2007 election, that started off over Bertie's finances down the tribunal and it looked awful for him. Now, I happened to be covering the tribunal. I was one of a few reporters
who
knew exactly how bad this thing was.
Yeah.
But it wasn't obvious to most people. He sailed through a brilliant victory from his point of view. 6 months later, he was gone. Mm. Apart from the economic legacy that Ciara's talking about, that stuff, that Micheál Martin, who's the last man standing from that cabinet, would want that stuff to be dragged up again. I just find it difficult to believe. I may be completely wrong. It may well be.
And yet there is, McClifford, a lot of coverage, like quite a number of columnists.
What else? Shane Ross, as Brendan, Shane Ross has suggested.
Owen O'Malley as well.
Owen O'Malley and Shane suggested that, he suggested that Heather Humphreys wouldn't be a winner, which I was a bit surprised. He does make one very good point, and that is in relation to the proportional representation. If, for example, you had Catherine Connolly now and say Sinn Féin put forward a strong candidate, both would be perceived as the left and the transfers from one to the other would be nearly, to the greatest extent, one go to the other, which I'd suggest would quite possibly put them over the line. Whether the same thing might apply if you had a strong candidate with Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael, quite possibly. But he says that Bertie is certainly in with a shout as well.
Ciara, you know, we've had the ceasefire babies and we've also had, you know, CMAT talking about kind of the recession babies, you know, and we probably haven't heard enough about, you know, from your generation about the impact of growing up, you know, in the days of the Troika and how that affected younger people. Do you think that if someone like Bertie Ahern stepped forward that, peace process notwithstanding, that it would activate a youth vote in circumstances where young people tend not to vote as well as older people?
I would hope so. I think one of the issues with the youth vote in Ireland is that most people who are really dissatisfied leave. We exercise exit over voice. So emigration is, you know, once again, the issue of, you know, all the people around me constantly. It's all my friends are in Australia and I am considering going to, because logically it absolutely makes sense. And I think, you know, I think
some by necessity, some by rite of passage.
I don't think yes, there are people who emigrate because, you know, there's a culture of emigration because it's important. But increasingly, so many people my age are emigrating. And actually, you know, I'm 30, so kind of beyond the age that a lot of people tend to emigrate. And it's they're saying, you know, well, you know, I can't afford rent. My quality of life here is so poor. But I think one of the reasons is that also, you know, post-crash, we didn't really have an analysis of, OK, what decisions were actually made during the boom that actually left us in this position. And it was really framed, and I think that if Bertie does run, he will frame it as, oh, it was an international crisis, we had nothing to do with it. The policies that were pursued by several of his governments absolutely, and there is a significant amount of research on this now, absolutely left us in an absolutely disastrous position. You know, cutting taxes on the rich during a boom that left us entirely reliant on the construction and property industry in a clear property bubble that was transient, that then totally decimated our tax revenues when it actually came. Things like the SSIAs, which poured fuel on the fire and created this really unsustainable credit boom. I mean, it was a domestic, you know, a five-part crisis, but we had an international and we absolutely had a domestic crisis that multiple of those governments were.
So, McClifford, moving to the only declared candidate so far, Catherine Connolly, then, mindful of what Ciara is saying, is the ground ready for a left candidate? Some tough questions for Catherine Connolly over the weekend in some of the interviews that she's given.
Yeah, and she was interviewed by Mary Regan in the Sunday Indo today, and you know there are issues around, and she's answered them. But and I think Mary finishes the piece of saying the level of answering, she might have to go deeper than that as a campaign goes on. But you know there are issues around her visit to Syria with other parliamentarians, her support for the candidacy of Gemma O'Doherty in 2018, and she answered that. And there are some issues of that nature, her associations with Mick Wallace and Claire Daly in some of these things. But she definitely is somebody who has a chance. Like, the only thing, and in that, as the other thing she said in there is that she wants to be a voice for the Irish people. Now, I have a bit of a kind of a question mark arises with that. What exactly is this voice for the Irish people about? Is it suggesting that I thought the voice of the Irish people is the people we elect as a government? I mean, is it suggesting that if the government is doing something unpopular, the president comes forward? No, Michael D did that to some extent, but let's remember he did it on the back of huge personal popularity to the extent that nobody in the government was ever going to haul him up on it.
But are we sort of, you know, interviewing somebody, lots of people for a role that doesn't have the best job description? You know, we're talking Brenda Power about, you know, setting the tone for, you know, the national conversation. The role, as we've discussed endlessly, is quite restricted in one set, and yet at the same time is hugely valued by the public.
Shane Coleman has a piece in the Business Post about the kind of president he said he doesn't want, which, to my reading of it, some of it might refer to more
Once
recent...
Patrick Hillary,
yeah, he's
2.0.
Suggesting I throw back to the likes of Patrick Hillary, who was very... He went around the community groups. He was very vocal in certain instances, but he did not in any way appear to challenge the government or whatever, and that he fulfilled the role as per designed by the Constitution, apparently. But, to be fair, as you say, it's a bit elastic what exactly
and Brenda,
the job
are we
description
looking,
is.
Are we looking for presidents like children to be largely seen but not really heard? Is that what we want? Or, because the presidency has evolved in recent decades.
It has evolved, but I mean, at the same time, I think when people like Michael McDougall said that they were not interested in running because they understood the limitations of the role and knew that you can't actually use it as a personal soapbox, that's not what it is intended to be. And I agree with Mick. I mean, what voice the president has that an elected politician does not have is a bit bewildering. I see in a piece in I think it's the Mail, the interview with Garrett Sheridan, where he's all over the papers today. He spoke to everybody, but he was asked, you know, what
he
is
he also
your
said
answer?
That everybody told him not to bother.
Not to
that
run.
It would be
treacherous. Not to run, but he was mad, and he said housing is going to be his pitch, and his slogan is going to be "Make Ireland Home Again." And he has, of course, been pulled up on the MAGA sort of echoes to that particular phrase. But he was asked, you know, in the Mail piece, what is your proposal then on housing? And he said, well, I don't have answers to it right now. But, you know, collectively as a voice, we need to bring, as a country, we need to bring more voices into it. I mean, have we not heard enough?
Yeah. Or at least but Ciara, what do you think of that? You know, housing. Because, you know, obviously 35 is the, you know, the eligibility age. Mm. He is trying to position himself as a voice for that younger generation, the generation that you have described that is, you know, suffering all of the impacts of the crisis, you know, including housing and other issues. So he's trying to pick a theme. Mm-hmm. Is he succeeding?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, I love seeing young people getting involved. At the same time, he's not exactly representative of the average young person who's struggling in Ireland. And while it's wonderful to aim to be that voice.
The average young person in Ireland probably couldn't mount a campaign that requires up to 750,000 euro.
But I do think, I mean, we have huge intergenerational inequality issues in Ireland. And, you know, obviously the last 15 years have hugely exacerbated that. So I think, you know, a voice pointing that out will never hurt, because at the end of the day, with the housing crisis, for most of the country, especially most of the older generation, the housing crisis is not an issue.
It's not an issue if you've got a home.
But also, sorry, can I just say just about Gareth Chardon, in fairness to him, he could be somewhat of a role model, because his father was a painter. He said he earned the money to, you know, to go to America to start up his business by painting the outside of houses in Kimmage on cold days, because his father made him work for every penny that he got. And he has made a success of himself, and he's 35. So, I mean, I'd love to see him get on the ballot paper. I sincerely hope that he does. And I think, I mean, I think that should, one of the things that is constantly thrown at Catherine Connolly is that she did support Gemma Doherty in 2018. I certainly wouldn't hold that against her. I think the more people ballot paper.
She was quite known. She was saying, well, look, I supported the nomination. She was saying,
I'm not
in.
Exactly.
So it was quite known.
Exactly.
Graham, there was an interesting piece, I think it was in, you know, the Business Post, about should business people, you know, be running for a role like this. And it was just something, you know, Mick was saying earlier, probably, or Brenda as well, you know, probably those who survive these contests are people who've been through political processes like elections, where they've, you know, kind of gone through that. Do you think there is a role for you know, business people to who've been successful in that part of life to come forward and try and be the voice of the nation?
I'm always suspicious of the, you know, Michael O'Leary should be running the country sort of view, which is, you know, because if you want to run the country like Ryanair, you know, you're going to have lots of cuts. And you're not going to have unprofitable things being rolled out like healthcare. And it's just, it's not how a government works, but especially not for the office of the president, who doesn't get to do any of that anyway. Right. So I'm very leery of celebrity candidates, right? Because again, their brand often trades on being, you know, controversial or saying random things, and because they tend to surround themselves, I've actually written a bit about celebrity politics and diplomacy, they tend to surround themselves with, like, yes people anyway, who will not rein them in when they say something absolutely daft or uninformed. And we're seeing it with Donald Trump, for example. But second to that, I think business people who've simply become rich through some particular industry, you know, great. If we need advice about pharmaceuticals, by all means, go ask Gareth Sheridan. But, you know, for the office of the presidency, it doesn't qualify you at all.
Keir, you are nodding effusively there. Should they not, should business people not be putting, who can be charismatic and visionary and show great leadership skills?
Charismatic and visionary is not what you need to be in public life. You need an understanding of the system. You need an understanding of how, you know, of the state and of history and of the philosophy and, you know, what do we stand for? What do we not stand for? What are the international issues? Because these are kind of issues that the president is...
Politicians.
It's also, you know, I also kind of have a little bit of an issue with how much that's lacking in our politics as well, that kind of understand that big systems thinking. You know, there's no real training for it in Ireland. And I'm very sceptical of people who say, oh, well, I did well in business, so therefore I can apply that. I don't think that, you know, doing well in business qualifies you to run the state.
I think disqualify you.
I think more businesses in, like, you know, business people coming from the business industry into the civil service to implement, to get, you know, to those outside views there. But for big visions, I really think I would love to see more of this really systematic understanding of policy, of systems.
What other sectors then should we be drawing people from? Because it is people who have been in public life, usually through a political cycle or a number of them that tend to come forward?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I suppose I would love to see kind of more policy systems education so that that ends up kind of more in our public life. And also, you know, the kind of the public sector that's not politics. I mean, most of the public sector is not politics, right? Politics is quite a small part of the big sphere of, you know, the civil service, the research sectors, which I don't think necessarily qualifies you either.
The other thing about Gary Sheridan, in fairness to him, like, he's young, he's a successful business person. Personally, I think people like that should be in politics. The problem is they should be in the type of politics that operates in the Dáil, where change can be effected, not in ceremonial roles, because they're not going to change anything there. Like, I mean, I think that to me is the biggest issue in the whole thing.
I mean, the point, Graham, you were saying, you know, that you tend to end up, or at least that it attracts celebrity candidates. But as we've conceded, it is a role in which charisma plays a big point and plays a big role. And these people do have that advantage. I was very taken with a piece Ryan Tuberty wrote today in the Mail. Can I just quote you a line from it? He says, "I continue to be baffled by the unhinged nature of presidential election coverage. I understand there must be scrutiny and that the campaign is one long job interview. But is there any need for all the frothing at the mouth? I'm not trying to be Pollyanna here. Candidates must be accountable, have their ducks in a row. But why the constant negativity rather than a balanced look at our putative presidents? Why not counter the bloodthirsty coverage with a nod to Riverdance as the international success story, or the largely successful navigation through COVID when we were scared out of our wits, or even the Good Friday Agreement?" I mean, there is a point to be made to say, look, are we too? You see, the problem is we tend to enjoy this, I'm afraid, as entertainment.
We do.
And that's maybe not the best way to approach.
And that might be not the best reflection on us all. But I'm going to have to take a quick break. We'll back with you shortly.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome back. With me are Mick Clifford, Ciara Murphy, Graham Finlay and Brenda Power. Now, I mentioned it at the start of the programme, but there's a really, really poignant front page piece, Mick Clifford, in the Sunday Times, widespread coverage elsewhere of the recent death of 9-year-old Harvey Morrison. First of all, can you just remind us about little Harvey?
Yeah, Harvey, as you said, he died there recently. He was 9 years of age. He suffered from both scoliosis, as I think people will be aware now, is an extremely painful spinal condition, and spina bifida. And he died recently. The exact cause of death is not determined. However, what we do know is that he was waiting for an inordinate length of time for an operation for the scoliosis. He was first, suppose, August 22. He was put on a waiting list. He was due to have an operation in April of 23. That didn't occur. By August the 24th, his parents found out, they're saying against or without their knowledge, he was taken off a list. He ultimately had the operation there, I think, about 3 months before he died earlier this year. Now, that's also in the context of when Simon Harris was the Minister for Health. He said, following an earlier episode where somebody's plight was highlighted in the media, he said that no child would be waiting more than 4 months for this operation. Quite obviously, the parents they're interviewed in the Sunday Times are extremely hurt and angered by this, and suggesting...
And many people, McClifford, will remember when that statement was made. It really felt as if it was a line in the sand. But I think Gary Murphy, I think, has a piece in the Sunday
he's
Times
a very
when
good
he was
piece.
Saying that the risk of making promises, politicians making promises on matters that may be outside of their control.
Absolutely. Outside of their control. I mean, you're talking about so many variables. You're talking about priorities within the HSE. What you're also talking about is that ministers are transient. That's the nature of the job. Simon Harris was then Minister for Health. Now, if he was to faithfully keep that promise, for example, in a political sense, every month he'd be looking for updates on lists. He'd be looking for shortages of, for instance, theatre nurses, surgeons, operating theatres, all the aftercare, all of that. But he moved on. He left health, he moved on, he's leader of party, etc., he's Taoiseach. And he wasn't in a position to make that promise. But when you do make it, you're giving hostages to fortune. You're telling parents and children who are suffering horribly that this is going to get priority, and it doesn't. Just very briefly, a similar thing, Simon Coveney, the year before that, when he was Minister for Housing, I distinctly remember him saying, and he said it publicly, that he would end people having to stay obtain emergency accommodation by the following June. We're 8-9 years down the line, it's still there. And Gary makes a very good point about that in his column today.
Yeah, he says we can accept that Simon Harris made his pledge in good faith. We can accept that he did all of he could in terms of engaging at the time, but perhaps that is meaningless because, you know, whatever about trying to make promises in an individual case when you apply that system wide.
Exactly.
And like this, Brenda Parr is in the context where there is a petition circulating calling for the Taoiseach to resign following young Harvey's death. And more than 26,000 people have signed that petition. By making that statement, did he kind of hold himself as a hostage to fortune?
He did. And again, that's the point that Gary is making. He's making it used to be a golden rule of politics. The politicians did not make promises outside of their control. And he said in that context, the call by Harvey's family for Harris's resignation is eminently reasonable. And this is really social media, actually, that has been driving this campaign over the last couple of weeks. And it was belatedly, I think, picked up by the mainstream media. And I see that the family are very driven in their desire to sort of settle scores over this. And I saw that they have announced a march now for next Saturday, what they're calling a No Flags March in memory of Harvey and also other children who are waiting for treatment. So, I mean, it seems that this family are very determined.
Yeah,
and they feel very bad.
Well, I don't know whether I would use the phrase settle scores. I think what they said today was that they told their son that they would honour him. They would honour
that.
But
they also said...
And for other children.
But they also said that people, you know, that you suffered and that we will make sure that the people who let you down...
Yeah. Where do they go to next, Mick, on this? Because it is, you know, I think so many people will be empathising that family who are in such the early stages of their grief.
I think he said he's been in contact with them and he's going to meet the family. I mean, Gary Murphy makes the point. I think it's probably accurate that he won't be resigning on the matter ultimately. But I mean, one would assume that what will come out of it is greater emphasis on getting this surgery done. Like, for example, there's 177 children, according to that piece in the Times, children are waiting for spinal surgery at the moment. 131 don't have a date for the proposed surgery yet. I mean, there's something, and I've seen this in other places. I've seen this in relation to, for example, special classes for children with additional needs. You have a scenario whereby there's a major story in the media, there's outrage, there's political reaction, there's promises, and then it fades and it keeps fading, and then it comes up again 2 or 3 years later. What you don't have is the political will to keep at it, to enforce it, when the media circus moves along, when the policy has to be enforced, when resources are required.
Because Brenda Parr, look, I mean, when you look at it, it isn't, you know, that Gary Murphy specifically references the increased healthcare in every spending budget since 2016. Graham, I know, and Mick referenced it, just the difficulty. It's not just the surgery alone. There is aftercare, there's intensive care, there are complications. These families need incredible support that moves beyond a single story or a media cycle.
It's really complicated. I mean, or in a way it's not. It crystallizes everyone's experience of the healthcare system, especially for children, whether it's youth mental health or anything. The waiting lists are very long. Even sometimes for people who have private insurance, which is only half the country, right? So, but to focus on scoliosis, where these commitments have been made, I think is appropriate. It appeals to, you know, it shocks people across the political spectrum. This is not a left-right issue. And the concrete pain and suffering of scoliosis sufferers in childhood is really graphic and horrible. And ultimately, in some cases, could be fatal. And we don't know anything about the outcome of this particular case. But... You know, and so I went and looked around at what other countries do. And again, Gary Murphy's piece is really good because it shows that the government did take steps, right? And elsewhere, Stephen Donnelly took a lot of steps.
On that, because Gary Murphy, I think, also notes that Pascal Donoghue said earlier in the week that when Mr. Harris became aware of the needs of Harvey's family, he did all he could in terms of engaging with the Department of the Health and the HSE. But it is about that broader systematic approach.
Well, it ran into scarcity of resources. So you had Stephen Donnelly, who was doing the kind of things Mick recommended, longer operating theatre hours, getting surgeons in, outsourcing to hospitals in London and New York and even France and through the National Treatment Purchase Fund. All the attempts to try and clear the backlog as they had promised. But they ran into scarcity of resources. And we see this in lots of cases with very expensive drugs or other kinds of surgeries. But ultimately, I think the public will hold the government to account for this because it was doable. And, you know, it would have been expensive, but they tried. I think the government made a good faith attempt to clear the backlog. But in the end, other countries can do it in short time. I'm just back from Canada, where the waiting time is about 4 months, which
Canada.
Is more appropriate.
Canada.
Yeah, single payer healthcare. It's great, you know. But also in other places in the UK, you know, the wait is not that long. It's longer than 4 months, but that seems to
well,
be the
well, actually, there's quite a bit of pickup in similar schemes to Natural Treatment Purchase Fund. If you go up to the part of the world where I came from, there's also complaints about waiting times. Ciara, can I just bring you in? It's on a separate but a related issue. The Sunday Times business section has a very good lead story, which is talking about the fact that Ireland is going to have to rely on immigrants to support our economic growth for years to come due to limited slack in the domestic market. They're saying that Ireland is reaching the limits of its domestic labour supply due to an ageing population and the widespread activation of the available pool of workers. And it ties into those recent debates that we've been having about the dependence that the Irish healthcare system has on migrant workers, particularly from countries like India.
Yeah, so this is based on a Department of Finance analysis that was published this week. And I thought it was really interesting because the framing in this piece is quite different, I think, from the framing of the actual review, which really says, you know, it will be really important also to improve activation in the Irish labour market.
So that is underemployment, unemployment, inactivity. Yeah.
Exactly. And of course, you know, there are big issues there. We have very high levels of no household work. A lot of that is to do with lone parents. A lot of it is to do with disability. So, you know, there have been a lot of conversations and calls about, I mean, childcare, I think, is one of the primary barriers. If you look at the price of childcare, for a lot of people, it is more expensive to work.
It's prohibitive.
Yeah, absolutely. Supports for lone parents and also supports for disabled people to be able to work. There is also, you know, there's also issues with structural unemployment and communities where unemployment has, you know, there's a, so this article almost kind of says, oh, the barriers to participation for those are so high.
Dermot O'Leary, he's a good body economist, he said the rising share of non-Irish nationals in employment is a result of the need for employers to attract talent from abroad in the context of full employment in Ireland.
Yeah, and I mean, full employment counts out of those who are active in the labour market. So it doesn't count labour market inactivity, but absolutely. So going forward, immigration is going to be a really important part of a lot of sectors, especially, and they point this out, because a lot of the sectors that Ireland is going to be relying on are very high skill sectors as well. So, you know, the gap between the currently labour market inactive or unemployed and those high skill sectors can be quite high. I don't think that means that we shouldn't do it, and I think it's going to be a real balance between the two.
McClifford, it's going to potentially be a much more, I suppose, spoken about issue, just migration and the needs of the economy versus obviously all the broader infrastructural stuff.
Oh, definitely. But I mean, I even recall the CSO there 3 or 4 years ago, projection the next 20 years, and they're talking about at least between 20,000 to 30,000 people who have to be coming into the country to work annually because of the ageing population in particular, and also Ciara's point about the high skill sector. But I mean, you know, there's no doubt that you have a lot of issues arising. You know, that Leo Varadkar has a very good column in the Sunday Times today about the kind of racism we've seen lately.
Yeah. He's sort of taking aim at the tech companies.
He is. He's very much taking aim at the tech companies. And he's also making a point that the people who are trying to spread some of that kind of agenda, they're suggesting that violent crime is up in the country and they're trying to relate this to increased immigration into the country. He's statistically making the point that violent crime is way down despite increased immigration into the country. By the way, the vast majority of which is to do with the labour market and not, as people are often targeting, asylum seekers.
He does sort of acknowledge, though, that perhaps the reason why people feel that there's more crime, because it's that lower, it's that public order.
Exactly. It's that non-violent crime is, you know, there's elements of it there that people feel. But as well, because of the online activity. And you have people, you have actors who are basically trying to promote that. You also, though, as he points out, have the tech companies that are allowing for that.
Yeah. Ciara?
This article really frustrated me. I think there's this real sense of, you know, it's fundamentally un-Irish. And he literally says, it is easy to blame the government, blame migrants or blame anyone else and face the possibility that they themselves did not make the most of the extraordinary employment and education opportunities that Ireland provides. So it's this real idea. And it's interesting that he throws in blames the government and blames migrants in the same sentence.
Is it sort of back into the people who get up early in the morning territory?
That's exactly it. And I mean, it is just total misunderstanding of the structural issues that face disadvantaged communities in Ireland. It's a total misunderstanding of the impact of adverse childhood experiences, traumas, the devastation that drugs have reaped on those communities for decades.
We spoke about it on the programme recently.
Yeah. A misunderstanding of the level of funding that has gone into the type of prevention work that that brings children away from that type of antisocial behaviour and into society. Youth work in 2008 was funded at 90.5 million. It's currently at 74.6 million, still 16% below. And it would, if it had kept track with inflation and population increase, it would be double its current rates. And a lot of that money has gone into youth diversion programmes, which wait until a young person has actually committed a petty crime or antisocial behaviour before it allows them to engage in the youth
and
work.
Should be getting them much earlier.
And if you look at the SICAP programme, that's our main social inclusion programme in the country, it's 35% below the 2008 rate still. So the idea that we give every opportunity to disadvantaged, I've talked to so many disadvantaged communities recently for a personal project, and a lot of them have said, it is the worst I have ever seen it. The conditions are the worst I have ever seen them.
Let's go from the worst you have seen to what Boris Johnson, Brenda, has described as the most vomit-inducing episode in modern diplomatic history. Lots of pieces, obviously.
Boris Johnson,
yeah. Do you know what? You can't sort of take it away from him. He's got a great turn of phrase. but himself and actually, there's been so much coverage on the meeting last Friday between President Trump and Putin. There was some nuances in what he was trying to say. It wasn't just the...
Yeah, I mean, I actually have to say I read Boris's piece, and again, he is saying, you know, nauseating as it is and sort of, you know, hard to stomach. And I think that's been the general reaction that you know, we're looking at this tyrant, this dictator being welcomed on the red carpet, whereas poor old Zelensky was roared at in Washington last year. But at the same time, that maybe we have to suck it up and maybe we have to take, you know, to stomach this. I think it's Peter Hitchens who has a piece actually saying, you know, this, we've had to have these conversations with these people in the past. He says, you know, JFK met Khrushchev, Nixon met the ghastly mass murderer Mao Zedong, Churchill drank brandy deep into the night with the unspeakable despot Stalin. You and I may not like this, but millions of us have lived peaceful, prosperous lives because of the squalid, despicable deals made by men of power.
And Graham Finlay, I think he was saying, you know, the, think of the people who are in the trenches and they suddenly see, you know, Vladimir Putin being described and welcomed as boss. You know, he said it is absolutely stomach wrenching. Senia Smotty has a good piece actually in the Sunday Independent. Weird and embarrassing, but not yet disastrous. Can he rescue some sort of triumph from the talks?
Yeah, I think she actually has a better take than Boris Johnson, and she has a very interesting point of view. So, yes, Boris Johnson says, you know, it would be horrible for the people who are suffering and dying in the trenches to see this, but, right, and his two buts are, one, we have to have a meeting. Trump should have had a meeting, maybe not quite this way, but he should have had a meeting to try and get some kind of agreement. So he and Hitchens don't disagree so much. But also he said that Trump has actually imposed secondary sanctions on traders like India, you know, who have been buying Russian petrol and gas, right? So, but that volatility is not really going to help get the kind of deal I think Johnson wants, which somehow involves Vladimir Putin giving up his vision of a vassal state in Ukraine. Whereas I think
he's not giving up that vision at all. He's just promising not to advance further.
Right.
If he's given,
and he wants more of the Donetsk, which he hasn't actually conquered yet. Right. But Ksenia Semity has a very different and more realistic approach, which is, you know, forget about what Putin thinks, right? What we need are enforceable security guarantees so he doesn't restart the war or invade again the moment it becomes better for him. You know, he has a bit of a pause and then he can start all over again.
It's interesting, McClifford, as we heard on the news, that the coalition of the willing, there's going to be a phone call today, and Vladimir Zelensky is on his way out to the US. There is an interesting question, and a lot of the analysts asked this morning, what is Europe's next move?
Well, it is. I mean, the thing has got so surreal. I mean, after that meeting, you had the scenario whereby Putin, he's a long-standing autocrat. He knows what he wants. He knows how to go about it. And you had Trump come in. The first interview Trump did, he talked about how Putin had told him he'd done great things since he became president and how the 2020 election had been stolen by mail voting. I mean, the thing is bananas. I mean, you've this... And it's buffoonery on one side, and on the other side, you have an autocrat who is systemically going about imperial expansion, effectively, of Russia. And you have, because Trump wants to isolate Europe, probably for economic reasons as much as anything, he's trying to relegate them, and he's moving towards Putin's position as if this war occurred rather than Russia basically invaded and tried to annex Ukraine.
And Graham, you know, Donald Trump is, he often talks about who holds the cards, who's got the stronger set of cards. Who does, going into this, obviously, Zelensky doesn't want to cede any land.
Well, that's it. Putin is clearly in a stronger position because he's prepared to sacrifice hundreds of thousands of lives to a few kilometres of territory. Zelensky is in a very bad position in that he, as he points out, the Constitution forbids him from ceding territory. Now, there's lots of ways to get around this. He can not formally cede territory, but he can recognize the facts on the ground, right, without giving away Crimea. But he is going to be under tremendous pressure from domestically not to cede any territory, which Putin hasn't already taken over, or Russia hasn't already occupied. And it's going to be very, very difficult for people like my friends who, under those conditions, would never return to their apartments, which they fled in the early stages of the war and the invasion. So, and again, I'm always struck by when you talk to Ukrainians on the street in Ireland that they worry about a civil war should any territory be ceded between the people who will never get back to their homes and the people who just want peace, right? So Zelensky's in a very, very difficult place. There are probably ways of getting around it. His only card is to prolong the war by fighting on. And if Donald Trump decides to shut off the tap of funding, which he has done over the last little while, that leaves it to Europe to go it alone. And can Zelensky keep the war effort up?
And obviously
with
that's
European
the strongest
stuff?
Hand that the US have to further deepen any economic sanctions.
Yeah. But European funding has exceeded that of the US just recently for the first time. It's not by Europe, though. Europe, as a security union, has not really been tested here. But it's from certain countries like the UK, the Nordics, you know, doing more.
Brenda Parr, how do you think this is going to play out in the wider context of Donald Trump and the MAGA base? You know, obviously the jobs figures, the impacts of the tariffs are starting to come through. It wasn't for a man who tries to perfect the art of the deal and the look when you had Fox News and others saying he skipped lunch, he got out of town. It's not a good look.
And Katie Balls has a good piece on that in the Sunday Times as well. Said this was a rare sight on Friday. Donald Trump playing second fiddle. Trump wanted a breakthrough. Putin wanted a show. And in the end, it was Putin who got what he came for and said in the US, there's less concern in the US than in Europe about the carving up of Ukraine. But Trump wants to show that he's a winner and a deal maker. And on that front, the Trump was not immediately helpful. Even the right-wing media raised questions about the optics of glad handling Putin while getting nothing in return. And I mean, there's a good analysis in I think it's in the Mail as well, by former British Defence Minister Tobias Elwood. He said he fears Zelensky is walking into a trap in full view of the world. He said the Ukrainian president will be presented with a take it or leave it deal, surrender territory or face the blame for wrecking peace. If he refuses, Trump will walk away saying America is done with you. He said it's a classic gangster deal when you can't refuse, except he must. So, I mean, the fear is another quote from Katie Balls. The fear is that warm words on security, which nobody believes Putin is ever going to keep, will be used to bully Zelensky into giving him what he wants.
And especially when if the deal is to maintain the lines,
the land,
where it is. Ciara, what did you take kind of from seeing it play out on Friday, the two presidents on the red carpet with it was almost like a wedding aisle, the B-52 bombers and everything. It was so surreal in some respects.
Yeah, I mean, it was absolutely bizarre. And I mean, it was very clear, I think, that Putin was kind of trying to make it like, oh, yeah, we'll talk about Ukraine, but also all these other things, and to really reframe and kind of take it away as well. And I suppose I think I take the point that these really difficult meetings sometimes need to happen. But I think a lot of people are saying not like this. Mm-hmm. And I think the key issue is, you know, at the end of the day, if Ukraine cedes territory, there is no guarantee that that's where the lines will stay, because there is no trust. And there is very good reason for there to be no trust.
So what does Europe do next, McClifford, then? And of course, there are broader questions, and it's quite a lively issue here, even just about the whole future of, you know, Europe as a security and defence union.
Yeah, it is. And you have to wonder what the future of NATO is in that context, in terms of Europe seems to be going one direction, the US in another direction again. You also have the issue of, and I mean, what everyone thinks of Donald Trump, apparently in terms of Europe, was it underfunding what's required for defence, and is there a greater need for defence now in the current world when you see the likes of...
And you could argue that what President Trump has succeeded in doing is making Europe raise its game on spending defence.
You could, but their focus is shifting as well between what the US wants, or, well, specifically what Donald Trump wants, who's effectively ruling the US now in every form, and what Europe wants. And I think, to be fair, to the greatest extent, Europe have Ukraine's best interests in mind. And I don't think that's the case with Trump in America.
It's been interesting when you look, there's so much in this White House, Graham. There's stuff happening all the time. But, you know, you see people like Gavin Newsom in California and really sort of stepping in and challenging Trump. And there are a mixture of factors. There is the economic, it is the jobs, it is the tariffs. And it's probably only in the next couple of months that we'll start to see the impacts of those once all of the inventory that they had been stocking gets out. So how do you think this is going to play domestically for him? Because the one thing he does not like being is humiliated, or being seen to be humiliated.
I mean, it is ultimately probably not the biggest issue confronting Americans. America's at a very, very unstable place right now. When ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, is just taking people off the streets in your neighborhood. And I talk to my American students and friends, and it's just...
The National Guard deployed,
they feel like they're
in D.C.
terrorized. Yeah, I mean, when you have the National Guard being federalized and tanks on the Mall in Washington, D.C. I mean, it's a very... This tends to focus the mind on what the U.S. government is doing in your actual country.
With plans to roll it out to other states.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And so this isn't a super salient issue, except for it plays into whether you hate Donald Trump or really love Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. But inside the Republican Party, there's a real division. And we saw that coming out after the very brief summit, where the, you know, anti-Ukrainian forces who never liked Zelensky, you know, are prepared to concede anything to Putin, which gets America out of the conflict. But the sort of the war hawks and the people who've been supporting Ukraine all along as best they can, given Donald Trump's wavering moods, like Lindsey Graham, you know, are sort of praising Trump for standing up to Putin, but also urging greater supports for Ukraine. It's something which divides the Republican Party. It divides the right wing in the United States. Ultimately, it's going to come down to the whims of one man.
How important is foreign policy for most Americans? You know, it is the price of eggs. It is, you know, the attention is turning to the domestic economy and the price of goods.
I mean, historically, it hasn't been important. And I think we're seeing that in the sort of weakness of, say, people like the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, in the face of really quite random and inconsistent actions by Donald Trump. He's got no one who's going to say no to him in the room this time. For younger people, I think it's, and my American students here, it's hard to imagine how salient the Palestinian issue and the invasion of and the bombing and destruction of Gaza is for American young people, because it's their tax dollars at work, right? But even that, I think, in the end, is going to pale when you have a Supreme Court which is allowing him to expand the powers of the presidency in ways which concretely terrify Americans in their very homes.
Yeah, and it'll be keeping an eye, as they all will, to the midterms. So we're going to take a quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very welcome. Brenda Power, Graham Finlay, Ciara Murphy and Mick Clifford with me. Brenda, we can't drink from the fountain of youth, but if you attend Oasis over this weekend, you might be able to reverse your ageing by about 30 years, if only for one night.
I know. It sounds like a fantastic show, actually, last night. I have to say, the reviews of it, even the sight of the two of them hugging and kissing, I mean, that's so moving. I actually did believe at the beginning...
I would also do that if I was going to get 57 million each from the first 14 shows alone.
But there were reports after the first few shows that they were leaving separately, that this was all a show for the cameras, and that there
they
was
stayed
great
in separate hotels. They were staying in separate hotels. Yeah,
that's right. And there was speculation that they will not make it to all 41 shows. I think the Australians hopefully this is a good sign.
And I'm really like giving a big shout. You can't all be from Mayo.
You can't
I think.
All be from Mayo. And they said, one of them said, this is the first time I've been sober in Ireland since I was 6 years old. And apparently they've forgotten that they did actually appear in Croke Park before playing GAA.
That's right, Noel did.
Noel did, sorry, yeah, Noel did, yeah, yes, yeah, he played in GAA. And their mother was there and they sent her hugs and kisses and so on. But I think even the rapprochement between them seems to be quite moving. And then the age group, while there were lots, of course, of middle-aged folk reliving the 90s, it seems to be in 17 to 70, so it sounds like a fantastic gallery.
McClifford, grown men crying.
Yeah.
Weeping.
I actually saw them 30 years ago this summer in Slane. They were backing up RDM. Now, I'd have to be honest and admit they're on the way up at that stage and I possibly didn't appreciate them enough. But when this started out, I was very cynical about it was just money, the way they did the ticketing and the whole thing. Mm. But look, if someone was to give me a free ticket,
what's
I'd be
good for Taylor Swift is good for well, they're not going to make as much as Taylor Swift, but I think Ciara, 400 million sterling possibly from this reunion tour. And Ian Guider was saying we should have an Oasis every month because it's the kind of tourism we should be building.
Yeah, it was interesting. So he was kind of making the point for these big events and the idea that we should be kind of not seeing them as a windfall, but try to bring them in structurally to the economy. I thought it was an interesting point. And, you know, he pointed out the need also for infrastructure around that if you want to do that. So things like public transport, enough accommodation. It's funny because I was at probably the opposite gig yesterday. I was at the Inchicore Festival, which is like a tiny little festival in the old CIE hall there. And it was all like really small local artists. And I think, you know, what I love about Ireland, and I think what draws so many people to Ireland consistently throughout the whole year is all the small little venues with local artists. And I think that's, for me, that's what I'd love to prioritise.
Yeah, and we'll be speaking to Terry Christian later, who talks about that, how they cultivated all these young bands. And Oasis were once a little small little band. But listen, that is all we have time for. We're coming up to lunchtime. My thanks today to Brenda Power, to Graham Finlay, to Ciara Murphy and to Mick Clifford for joining us this afternoon. And just to say that I would happily hug and kiss anyone I've ever fallen out with for 57 million. But thanks for joining us today. Let's cross over to the newsroom.